That's right. That was a good abbreviation. Nonlinear diffusivity is something that is quite important for all dynamos, in particular, as I believe, dynamos that are connected with the magnetorotation instability, which is the heading of this session. My talk will be tending towards dynamo theory, and in dynamo theory, we are, especially in an astrophysical context, interested in large-scale magnetic fields, and often these are being explained in terms of mean field theory. And the crucial ingredients of this theory are magnetic diffusivity and alpha, the alpha tensor alpha effect. I will be relatively brief, or extremely brief, on the magnetorotation instability, because there have been recordings on talks that I gave just a few weeks ago in Princeton and also here. I will then talk about the mean field paradigm, in particular what happens as we go from linear to the nonlinear regime, and we'll be focusing on the magnetic diffusivity that is one of the big final frontiers in understanding dynamo theory. Much of research in this, even connecting with simulations, has been done by calculating the alpha tensor or alpha effect, but not much has been achieved in terms of turbulent diffusivity. This is work that has been done over the last few years together with Karl-Heinz Redler, Matthias Reinhardt, and Kandaswamy Subramanian. There is a number of examples that we know of where large-scale magnetic fields have been found in simulations. Not talking here really about astrophysical objects, but hopefully, of course, some of the simulations are indeed representing reality at some point. As far as simulation is concerned, these are all simulations that have magnetic Reynolds numbers that are limited. They are going up to approximately 600, the largest one that I'm showing here today. Nevertheless, 600 is already highly supercritical as far as large-scale dynamo action is concerned. Large-scale dynamo action, by my counting of the Reynolds numbers, turns on at Reynolds numbers of approximately unity. So between 1 and 2, Reynolds dynamo becomes supercritical, so we are in many ways highly supercritical by factors of up to 300 easily. Here is an example of a simply helical turbulence. This is the simplest example that one can think of, where we see after a long time, after a resistively long time, the generation of a large-scale magnetic field in one of the components of the magnetic field. Note in particular that at early times, kinematic phase of the dynamo, there's no large-scale magnetic field really distinguishable. Another example, more closer than connected with real life, where we have often shear being important, is one where we have helical turbulence together with the shear flow. And what we see after some initial time is that we see a large-scale pattern both in the cross-stream field, cross-stream direction, that is Bx in this coordinate system, and in the stream-wise direction in particular, that's the Vy component. These are waves in a space-time diagram. This is time here in diffusive units, and this is the height in units of the basic wave number. So this goes between minus and plus pi. So we see waves that are propagating through a periodic domain, and this is happening for both weak shear and for strong shear. Yet another example is convection. So all these examples are with force turbulence. This is in some sense unrealistic because there's never anything like forcing in real life. More realistic situations are then the cases where the driving comes entirely from shear. And again, we find here in after a long kinematic phase where not much is happening as far as large scale is concerned, we just see noise both in the cross stream and the streamwise directions. And after a long time, we see the establishment of a large-scale magnetic field. Here is shown the Bx component. It's negative below the convection zone. This is convection in between stably stratified layers. Here, the unstable layer is from here to here as a dashed line, weakly shown. And a systematic orientation is throughout the entire convection zone. The, again, toroidal magnetic field shows a much more is much stronger and shows much fewer fluctuations. And then now, the example about the magnetorotation instability. where we see, and we have seen similar plots before, where Jim associated this phenomenon with the magnetic buoyancy. However, in this case, we associate this phenomenon not with magnetic buoyancy, but with the dynamo wave. And of course, in mean field dynamo theory, we do expect, like we have seen here already, once we have a shearing environment and once we have helicity in the flow, which is driven here in this case by the presence of stratification. So if the disk has rotation and stratification, we must expect helicity of opposite sign in the north and the south. This leads to cyclonic and anticyclonic vortices in the northern and southern hemispheres, similar to phenomenon on the Earth. So that drives helicity that has opposite sign, and so we do expect an alpha effect of opposite sign on the two different hemispheres. We do expect this oscillation frequency that has to do and is in this simple model equal to the turbulent magnetic diffusivity times the basic wave number of the mode. This is also seen in here. And so here we make a direct connection with the turbulent diffusivity and a phenomenon that is directly seen in simulations, namely the cycle period. For the sun, let me recall, this is a period of corresponding to 22 years. Here in these simulations, these are new simulations. In the 95 simulation already, we found similar behavior where the cycle period was on the order of approximately 50 orbits. The cycle speed, as we believe, has nothing to do with magnetic buoyancy, but it has again to do with the dynamo theory, and the cycle speed is proportional or equal to the magnetic diffusivity and the basic wave number. So this is really just a phase speed, omega divided by k. So these are a few examples where we know in simulations large-scale magnetic fields can occur. But in all those examples, the magnetic field of large scale is really only established at late times. So in the kinematic stage, as here is shown in example, both have resolutions of 512 cubed. These are high resolution simulations. Here the magnetic Reynolds number of 600. In none of these cases do we see large scale magnetic field in the kinematic stage. Now, is this a reason to believe that this phenomenon must then be a nonlinear phenomenon? Or is it perhaps something which is superseded by the small-scale dynamo operating at the same time? And we just have to wait until the large-scale dynamo overcomes the small-scale dynamo after a long time. I believe the latter is true. Let us look at the spectra, both in the kinematic stage and the nonlinear stage. In the kinematic stage, here we have is the velocity's power spectrum. This is forced turbulence driven here at one wave number. We see the establishment of something like an inertial range to the right, dissipation rate range further to the right, and we see a sub-inertial range where the kinetic energy is weak. What is called scale separation in mean field dynamo theory refers to the fact that we have a gap not anywhere in the Kolmogorov inertial range, but between the forcing range, or forcing scale, and the size of the system scale. And so here we see that we have a clear gap in the spectrum space, that is, not really a gap as such, but we do leave enough room for a large-scale magnetic field to establish at a scale different, larger, than the energy-carrying scale. So this is wave number in units of the basic wave number K1, and here the forcing is at wave number 4. Magnetic field is initially weak. And according to the theory by Kazantsev, which is valid primarily for large magnetic frontal number, but it has been shown to be reasonably useful also at different frontal numbers close to unity and possibly even below, somewhat below, we see that the magnetic power spectrum increases proportional with k to the 3/2. So if you have not heard about Kazantsev before and only about turbulence, this is something rather unfamiliar. A k to the plus 3/2. Magnetic power increases with the wave number. And it does not care at all about the forcing scale. So it really peaks at the resistive scale. And so by no means can we really talk about a large-scale dynamo here if the magnetic power is dominated by small-scale features. By contrast, if we wait until the final saturation time we see here, and this is now zoomed in towards the highest powers, we still see our inertial range, the dissipation range, and now we see that the magnetic energy has reached not only equipartition, but actually supra-equipartition at the largest possible scale of the system. And in fact, in this system where the box is fully periodic, we do make use, or the system makes use of the ability to put a large-scale field of Beltrami type, which is a force-free magnetic field. So a force-free magnetic field can have a power that is equal to the magnetic field at the equipartition scale, approximately here, multiplied by the wave number ratio to the minus one, as we see approximately. If you put a line through here that has a slope of minus one. Again, the kinetic energy at this large scale is very, very weak, or weak compared to the forcing scale. So this is what we have. So we don't see large-scale magnetic fields at all in the kinematics range. But let me now focus on this particular range, and let me multiply this power spectrum by 3/2, divide by 3/2 so that it would become flat, asymptotically flat. And let me focus here on the smallest few wave numbers, and let's put on red-blue goggles, which really means looking separately into positively and negatively polarized waves. This is sometimes called the Chandrasekhar-Kendall decomposition, and really corresponds to a positively negatively wave polarized wave decomposition. So if you do this, we clearly see in the non-helical case that the two are just the same. The power is roughly the same at the largest possible scale. There's a slight difference. But the really dramatic difference, already in the kinematic stage, where we don't really see any pattern as such, the really dramatic difference becomes apparent once we look at separately at the positively and negatively polarized wave. So you would not really see it until you really put on your red and blue goggles. So it's nothing obvious, but it's still there and can be measured. Now, as we go to the nonlinear regime, a lot of work has been done over the past decade or so, and this can be summarized into a concise formula, which is this formula, alpha quenching and alpha quenching formula. It's different from the alpha quenching formulas that are known to many people. What has been, of course, discussed over the decades, over the last two decades almost, is the possibility of catastrophic quenching. So if you forget about everything here in squared brackets up here, then we note that we have in the denominator a factor which has to do with the mean magnetic field strength divided by the equipartition field strength multiplied by a Reynolds number. Now, the Reynolds number is very large, 10 to the 9th in the sun, 10 to the easily close to 10 to the 15th in galaxies, if not even more. So this means that mean magnetic fields, much, much less than those that I've shown here in the examples before, would lead to a quenching of this entire factor by a dramatic fraction. Now, this is obviously not seen in those simulations, so something else must be going on. And in fact, this something else is all being encapsulated in these three different contributions in the numerator. All of these additional contributions are proportional to the magnetic Reynolds number itself. The first one is apparent and important already in fully periodic boxes. In periodic boxes, you can generate magnetic fields of Beltrami type. That means that the current is proportional to the mean magnetic field, and therefore J dot B is basically just the same as B squared multiplied by some wave number of the largest scale. So clearly, this term will be of the same order as this one, and both have an Rm factor. So clearly, once you have and allow for a Beltrami field to be developed, you can see that this entire catastrophic quenching can be completely alleviated, provided the magnetic diffusivity in the quenched regime is not itself quenched. Another possibility that we believe is astrophysically directly relevant or extremely relevant is the possibility of divergences of fluxes of current helicity at small scales, F sub C superscript SS. SS refers to small scale magnetic helicity. Small scale means smaller than the size of the system. For the sun, this would mean larger than the width of the of the dynamo belts, which means approximately 300 megameters. So anything smaller than 300 megameters is classified here as small scale. And we are looking for the current helicity flux at the small scales. If this is finite, and it will be finite in many systems of practical relevance, in particular those where we have shear. Here is shown a system, a quadratic box, or a cubic rectangular box that's elongated in the toroidal direction. We see contours of constant shear velocity. It's fast near this point, which is resembling the equator in a solar type simulation. Here, mid latitudes, it's getting slower, and it's also getting slower with depth. So we see here a pattern of differential rotation, and such differential rotation patterns are giving the possibility of driving magnetic helicity fluxes towards the boundary. And by then finally allowing the magnetic helicity to escape through the boundary, you can alleviate one more time magnetic or catastrophic quenching. It is believed to be much more efficient than any of the other two terms. And the final term has to do with the finite time derivative of the alpha effect. This cannot be neglected because this scales here with the magnetic Reynolds number. So eta Rm itself is proportional to eta t divided by eta, making this essentially a molecular magnetic diffusivity. So it's a very long time scale associated with this term here. What is shown here is a demonstration of the fact that with open boundary conditions, allowing for magnetic helicity flux to be left through the system, out of the system, you are able to reach mean magnetic field strengths relative to the total strengths that are easily close to or above 50%. Here it's approximately 70%. But if the system remains closed, this fraction remains close to the noise level at all times. So this is much of the understanding that has been provided by rather phenomenological approaches involving the concept of magnetic helicity conservation, and Eric Blackman will be talking on Wednesday in much more detail about this. So I mentioned this final frontier, which is the quenching of eta t. So in this formula, if we forget for a moment now the possibility of divergences of helicity fluxes and time derivatives, we see that in the stationary limit at large RMs, alpha should be equal to the actual value of the magnetic diffusivity in the quench regime multiplied by j dot b divided by b squared, which we can call a wave number km. So obviously, if eta t, which we have no control over as yet, not much at least, if eta t was also catastrophically quenched, much of this, what I've said, may need to be revised, because then alpha could still be quenched to rather small value. So it depends, rather critical, on whether or not this turbulent magnetic diffusivity survives in the nonlinear regime. This has been subject to a discussion since the 70s. There's a large number of review papers and research papers on this field. Here is shown a simulation by Youssef et al. In 2003, where the turbulent magnetic diffusivity has been estimated by just doing a decay experiment. So you take a large-scale magnetic field in forced turbulence. The scale of the forcing is smaller than the scale of the large-scale magnetic field. And we see as a function of time that the large-scale magnetic field amplitude decays here in these two different cases. But time, of course, is equivalent to the magnetic field strength, because as the magnetic field decays, the field strength decays. And therefore, we can directly take the time axis as the magnetic field axis, which is done here. And so the diffusivity is directly proportional to the amplitude of the field as it is at any given time. So we see here for the first time direct quenching curves of eta t versus time, or versus the field strength. And what we see here in one case where we have a helical initial magnetic field, we see that the quenching occurs at a value below the equipotential value, and here another example where the field strength is finite, where the initial field is non-helical, we see that there's no such enhanced quenching at early times. Quenching really occurs only once the magnetic field has equipartition field strengths. So these were just very early preliminary results, but they were consistent with an eta quenching in the non-helical case of the magnetic field, that is, where the magnetic field is proportional, in inverse proportion to the mean magnetic field amplitude. There's no squared factor, it's just the modulus of the mean magnetic field, and there is a proportionality factor, which is approximately 3. Similar fits have been also obtained in earlier work with Blackman and myself. So this factor 3, together with the linear dependence, appears to be quite common. But now let us try to get a much more accurate handle on this turbulent diffusivity. And this can be done by using a new novel method that Karl-Heinz Rehler will be talking about, I believe, on Wednesday, which is called the test field method. So briefly, the test field method involves solving an additional equation in addition to the magnetohydrodynamics equation. You may know this equation from textbooks of mean field electrodynamics, because this describes the evolution of the fluctuating magnetic fields for a given mean magnetic field. Now, what we will do here is assume that the given magnetic field is really independent of the actual magnetic field in the simulation, but it's rather one of the sine and cosine fields in either the x direction or in the y direction. So there's 4 different such test fields, dot, 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 which we can apply. And for each of these test fields, we can calculate the electromotive force and can determine from this equation, which we assume represents this electromotive force in terms of the mean magnetic field and its derivatives, we can calculate these 8 fit coefficients, alpha 1, 1 through eta 2, 2, and the k is always 3. This can be done by simply inverting a rotational matrix. This has to do with the form of the test fields that are chosen. It's not a Fourier decomposition of any type. So Karl-Heinz will be talking about this in more detail, but let me show first of all what we get in the kinematic regime. In the kinematic regime, remember, so this is the magnetic Reynolds number, and I told you Reynolds numbers of the order of unity are the critical ones for here. Here we go from clearly sub-unity values, below 0.1 even, up to approximately 200. And what we see is that there is a regime when the system is really viscous and resistive, which is the case for magnetic Reynolds numbers below unity. So unity is here the critical value. Below unity, we have an inverse proportional increase of both alpha and eta t with magnetic Reynolds number. But once the magnetic Reynolds number is bigger than unity, we achieve a regime where both are approximately constant. And what are their values? The values are, to a high degree, consistent with the values that we used for normalization. So we have normalized alpha by alpha naught, and alpha naught is here defined as minus 1/3 times a tau times the kinetic helicity of the system. The kinetic helicity in the system is fully helical, and that means for all practical purposes, that this entire expression tau times the kinetic helicity is equal to the RMS velocity. So the alpha effect is just 1/3 of the RMS velocity. It's a rather large value, and it's true clearly within error bars. For eta t, it's the same thing. We have 1/3 times tau times u squared, and again, if we replace the tau by the turnover time. In this fashion, URMS times KF, and it would be multiplied normally by an undetermined coefficient, the Strouhal number, which has been calculated earlier to be unity. So this would then be the relevant equation. Then this eta t is just 1/3 times the RMS velocity divided by the wave number of the energy carrying eddy. So again, this eta t is close to unity in this normalized fashion. This is work by Sharon Yeshua earlier this year. So this was a kinematic, but now let us turn from the linear to the nonlinear regime. What we have to do is the following. So in both cases, we use the same test field equation, but the test field method, of course, has to use a certain velocity field, which can come from any type of system. It can come from an MRI simulation, from a convection simulation, or a forced turbulence simulation, as this one here. So the velocity field is the solution of the momentum equation, as in this case. But the velocity field here feels the effect of a Lorentz force. And this is a Lorentz force that is consistently generated from the same velocity field. So A is the magnetic vector potential, and B is the curl of it. So these are the differences as you go from linear to nonlinear. The test field equations use separately ingredients from the mean velocity and the fluctuating. So both have to be separated before this test field method can be applied. In the nonlinear regime, we must expect alpha to take on tensorial form. In the very simplest case, we expect that there will be additions to the alpha tensor, which are not just equal to the Kronecker delta, but at least proportional to the product of the unit vectors in the bi and the bj direction. This means typically that if you just take the average of this alpha tensor in any such direction, you will of course get the average of alpha, but you will not. But you will only typically get, if you have a sine wave, for example, typically one half of alpha 2. So just taking an average of the alpha will not give you the right value, in particular because alpha 1 and alpha 2 are close in their values. There's a tendency for these two values to cancel each other. Eta t has the same formula here. Now, as the possibility of a consistency check, we are first of all interested in looking at the steady state. That's simply because we do want to avoid additional work here with looking at the time derivatives of the alpha. So we are looking at the final state where the magnetic field is already saturated. And in that case, we do expect that the dispersion relation for a steady state is approximately valid in this case. And that means that the growth rate, lambda, should be equal to the whatever alpha is multiplied by the wave number and minus the diffusivity times the wave number squared. And we expect this to be unity. And it turns out to be unity within error bars. This is a good check of the consistency of this method. Here the result. We see that in all cases, we have magnetic field strengths that are self-consistently generated and turn out to be close to equipartition or super-equipartition. We find that as a function of magnetic Reynolds number, alpha decreases as you go from a value of approximately 2 here to 600. Alpha decreases by a factor of approximately 15. And eta t decreases by a factor of approximately 5 as you go all the way to 600. Now, alpha cannot decrease any further because then the dynamo would be subcritical, which of course is not the case. We are, in all those cases, working with a dynamo which is supercritical. So that clearly means that alpha is bounded from below by this eta t curve. And the eta t curve shows a behavior that may either continue going down for larger RMs, we don't know, or it may even level off. So this is work for the future that needs to be done. Here, this table summarizes simply that the growth rate is close to unit, close to zero, and here alpha 2 tends to cancel alpha 1, leaving a small value of alpha here in this column. And the contributions to eta 2 are small. So one more thing. In this equation, it does not mean that alpha 1 is a kinematic value. Both are functions of B. So alpha 1 is a function of B and alpha 2. So this is really just a tensorial form. And so altogether, we have four quenching functions that are here for the first time calculated. Now, finally, the question about the additional cooperation of this phenomenon with a small-scale dynamo. In all our cases, we have calculated alpha and eta as a function of time and z. Typically, we average over z, except in the nonlinear regime. This cannot be done. This would give wrong results. We have to multiply beforehand by the corresponding spatial dependencies. But what we find is that alpha is a function of time all the time. So there are fluctuations in alpha, but as we wait, these fluctuations actually seem to increase. So there's a basic level of fluctuations, and this level of fluctuations increases with time. We believe this has to do with the occurrence of more than just one dynamo at the same time. So the system has a large number of different modes being excited. Some of them may be associated with a small-scale dynamo, and others may be associated with yet other types of large-scale dynamos. The system itself will, of course, choose one, but the test field method will still be able to detect or generate self-consistently any one of those. This is not what we want to look at, of course, the additional dynamos. We just want to have the alpha effect that is determined and the eta effect that is determined by the averaged value of approximately these things. These values of alpha and eta t. The question now is, are these averages actually well determined? Or is there the possibility of divergence? And so what I'm showing here is for the case of a Roberts flow, a rather dramatic case. So we see here as a function of time that the that there's a Reynolds number of approximately 100, an additional mode is being excited. And it's being exponentially increasing with time, possibly potentially destroying the entire method of calculating alpha and eta t. But we believe the two are completely separate quantities, and by averaging over time, we can get rid of this. So what is shown here is the next solid line here is showing these oscillations, the same oscillations in huge magnification. So the dashed lines already are a huge magnification of this one here. This goes all the way up to 600 or 1,000. This one goes only up to 0.2, much, much smaller. By doing a running mean of this curve, we obtain the solid curve, which is shown here. And by calculating a running mean on this still exponentially increasing curve, we see a very well-determined average value, which is clearly different from unity here. Same thing here. Here is from different from zero. Here is shown zero, and here is shown the result of a doubly accumulated average calculation. So, in summary, then, we believe that this test field method is an extremely powerful method that can be applied to a large number of systems, to convection, to MRI. Both cases have been done already, and also now to the nonlinear case. And in the nonlinear case, the question of this dish of a small-scale dynamo, as we believe, is a technical issue which has to do with separating exponential time dependence from a meaningful background value. So the techniques that we incorporate here is involving both time averaging and, in practice, also restarting of the BPQ. BPQ can be restarted at any given time from zero. It will quickly come to a certain value. And once the fluctuations become too large, which is the case after the fluctuations have reached approximately 20 times the equipartition value, which is rather large already, we restart this calculation to gather more statistics. So we accumulate a lot of these such curves to calculate meaningful averages. So that is the summary of my talk, and thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. Some questions.
My question is about numerical simulations of large-scale dynamo. So it seems that large-scale dynamo, in some sense, is a diffusion process. So we don't really care about the spectrum of small-scale fluctuations. So would it be easier to leave more resolution for large scales and reduce the inertial interval?
I don't think so. If you do want to address the question of what happens at large or n, so what you are saying is you want to leave more space between here and here.
Yeah,
you can certainly do that, and at the same time you would decrease the width of the inertial range, and the width of the inertial range is just the same as Rn. So the width from here to here is basically just Rn. So if that's what you want to do, you can do this at the expensive price of reducing the magnetic Reynolds number. And it certainly has been done. I've been going up all the way up to 30. And then in that case, you have no inertial range at all anymore. So those cases have been studied. And of course, it's quite meaningful, but it's really low Rn.
So in these simulations, you have a maximally helical velocity field.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, Axel. You talk about the fact that having open or closed boundaries for the magnetic helicity will help or not having a large scale magnetic field. But we have heard already that in geodynamo, even in stars, when we make them rotate faster, we can also get larger mean fields. So I wanted to know your opinion on the influence of rotation in the picture you just described us.
Yes, I think you're talking about this case here. As I said, magnetic helicity fluxes will be crucial in alleviating quenching by having a significant term of this form here. The jury is still out whether or not this one is, or how big this one really is. It depends very much on how much eta t is quenched in the nonlinear regime. As I said, we have found here quenching by a factor of 5. That would mean that, for example, for the sun, the standard solar dynamo would be quenched, or this eta t would be quenched by at least a factor of 5. It must be clearly more than that, but possibly not RM dependent. Now, this eta t, as the more it is quenched, the longer the cycle period becomes. And if you recall the very first dynamo models of the sun, which are all global models of the sun, no longer models which are where the dynamo operates in specific layers, but throughout the entire convection zone, in all those models, the cycle period came out to be too short. It was on the order of between around typically 3 years. So a quenching by a factor of at least 10 would be required, certainly, in order to explain the cycle periods of 22 years. But in many of the simulations that we have seen so far, the frequency is still rather long, and we are still not quite sure whether this would be sufficient to explain this solar dynamo entirely. In all the cases where there's shear in this system, we clearly know that magnetic helicity can be transported by a specific mechanism that we often call the Vishniak-Chow mechanism, because they derived the possibility of a divergence of such a flux for the first time in the presence of differential rotation. So those differential rotation contours give a flux along those contours of constant shear. And this, if it has a finite divergence, which it will have in many geometries such as this one, then this one will provide a very definite means of alleviating catastrophic quenching.
Yeah, regarding this equation, so let's say you have a periodic box, so there's no flux, so the flux term goes away. So at large RM, that's either the first or the third term that dominates. And if it's the first term, you say you have a eta j dot b, and that can help out by increasing alpha. But the helicity dissipation of the mean field will be increased by the same factor, right? The d by dt of the large scale helicity goes like eta j dot b. So would you inhibit the dynamo that way, and which effect wins out?
Oh, the dynamo is inhibited by in simplistic forms, form which is incorporated in here, but in a less obvious way. It's inhibited by the fact that you do produce small scale magnetic current helicity, which attenuates the kinetic helicity. So there's an alpha magnetic and alpha kinetic which approach each other, and the sum of the two is what is called alpha here. And this is the unattenuated value. So the quenching is really described by the two approaching each other. But I believe you formulated your question in a somewhat different way, so maybe you didn't quite answer that one. Yes, of course, that is...
Sorry, d by dt, the viscous, the ohmic dissipation of the large-scale helicity goes like eta t j dot b. So I'm saying you're increasing the alpha effect, but you're also increasing the dissipation.
Yes, but the... So first of all, the large-scale magnetic helicity is determined on the molecular value, but then it also depending on whatever the EMF is. So it's actually alpha b squared minus eta t jb. So it's not just this one which modifies or controls the evolution of large-scale magnetic helicity as opposed to total, but it's also the alpha term directly times b squared. So it's much smaller than what you think it would be. But clearly, large-scale magnetic helicity is no longer a conserved quantity. I mean, it's the sum of large-scale and small-scale magnetic helicities that is a conserved quantity. So as much as large-scale magnetic helicity grows at this time, by the same amount you must produce small-scale magnetic helicity at exactly the same amount, which is controlled both by eta t and the alpha effect.
Axel, can you get back to your equations to compute the test field?
Yes.
Yeah, this one here.
So I'm not sure I understand this equation. If you have a, if you want to measure this coefficient for large Rm, you'll get the small scale dynamo as well as the mean field dynamo, and therefore the fluctuations are due to two processes at the same time,
yes,
like turbulent induction by
that's
the mean
right.
field and the small scale dynamo. So how do you assess the relevance of the method in that case?
At the moment, it's really by plausibility. We have achieved results. So what could have happened, of course, is that you have the large-scale dynamo and the small-scale dynamo, and both modify each other. So what you then measure in terms of what we think is alpha is actually no longer the actual alpha. And the fact that our results are consistent, both in the kinematic regime and in the nonlinear regime, consistent in the sense that the alpha and eta t result in a growth rate which is either equal to the actual growth rate in the system or it's zero in the stationary case. This consistency gives us hope that what we actually have determined are meaningful values consistent with what we expect they should be from dynamo theory. So it's certainly not proven, but it's becoming exceedingly plausible because they are quite separate and meaningful. At the same time, let me emphasize the averages turn out to be stationary averages. It's just a technical issue to isolate them from the fluctuations. So the running mean remains still steady within accuracy of this running mean.
Okay, one last question for lunch.
When introducing anisotropic alpha and eta, you eventually have an electromotive force terms that are linear in the large-scale field and cubic in the large-scale field. So is there any good reason for omitting in the electromotive force terms that are second order in the large-scale magnetic field, for example?
Oh, you are referring to this formula here. So these functions alpha 1 and alpha 2 and eta 1 and eta 2, they are completely general nonlinear functions of B. So they can go up to arbitrary order in B. So it will be B cubed terms, B and higher orders. It's just a functional form that is here proportional, and there cannot be any other one because there's two components. So in this case, it can either be only B1, BJ. There's no other tensorial combination, unless, of course, you allow for a current. Now, in these simulations, the current is in the same direction as the mean magnetic field, and you cannot distinguish between the two. But in general, there would also be terms like the unit vector of the mean current, times B in the two different directions, and the same with J, I, J, J. So that would be the most general form if the only effect to the tensorial nature of these tensors comes from the magnetic field itself. In many practical situations, there will also be rotation, stratification, and shear. They provide additional means of having anisotropies in the system. But there would be only this one in the present system where we have Beltrami waves, Beltrami fields, or there could be altogether five coefficients, 5 + 5, in the case of periodic systems where there's, for example, shear or stratification. Shear, for example. No, because shear is already more than that. But at least if you lift this degeneracy, there would be 5 + 5 additional components. So at least nothing cubic in the tensorial nature of these tensors here. Because it's just two components, it's rank 2 tensors.
Okay.